you get rid of it.
That's cartoonist and author Ted Rall talking about his book, The Anti-American Manifesto. We'll spend most of the hour with him. Then we'll check in with poet Martina Spada as he reads a poem about the pro-democracy people's rebellion in Mexico, the Zapatistas. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Riano. If you're like me, you've been glued to the TV or internet following the history-making pro-democracy uprisings that are spreading throughout the Middle East. The spark was first lit in Tunisia, leaped to Egypt, and now is blazing up against other repressive regimes from Bahrain and Yemen to Iran. But what about right here at home? No less a figure than Bob Herbert, columnist for the New York Times, asked whether it was time for Americans to follow Egypt's example. And my guest from most of this hour has written a book about just that. He takes inspiration from America's founding fathers, whose American Revolution sparked a wave of rebellion, much like the one we're beginning to see today. Thomas Jefferson famously said, "Experience has shown that even under the best forms, those entrusted with power have, in time, perverted it into tyranny." And he called for a revolution in each generation. Well, in his new book, Ted Rall says the time for a new revolution has come. He's probably known to most listeners as the trenchant political cartoonist who's long graced the op-ed pages of the New York Times and other publications syndicating his work across the U.S. But Rall has also been a columnist for a United Press syndicate, produced a radio show in L.A., and published numerous books, including Wake Up, You're a Liberal, How We Can Take America Back from the Right, Silk Road to Ruin, about Central Asia, and most recently, The Anti-American Manifesto. He says the political system in the U.S. is corrupt and unreformable, and it's time for a people's revolution because, as difficult and chaotic as that may be, it's far better than the catastrophe we face if we don't take action. Ted Rall, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Your book, The Anti-American Manifesto, I first want to ask you, why did you call it The Anti-American Manifesto?
It was originally supposed to be called The Post-American Manifesto. The idea was what comes next after the United States inevitably collapses. And one night I was up late thinking about what people would say when they read the title. And I thought, well, all these right-wingers on Fox News and other places will accuse me of being anti-American. That's what they always say. So I thought, you know, I'm just going to appropriate this in the same way that back in the 60s, a lot of outrageous titles were appropriated for book titles. So I thought, you know, once you call yourself anti-American, it sucks all the wind out of the insult.
And it doesn't seem to actually have hurt. I mean, I've been surprised to see that you've been interviewed on, is that right, Fox?
No, MSNBC, Dylan Radigan Show.
That was it. And also you did a reading, I believe, just yesterday at the East Hampton Town Library.
That's true. I've been at the University of Michigan Main Library at Ann Arbor. I've been at a lot of respectable bookstores. I've done lots of radio interviews. I mean, for sure, the title has not prevented me from getting on a lot of important venues. However, it has kept me off the Comedy Central shows, Daily Show and Stephen Colbert.
Why?
They just are not really true. They're not leftists. They're really militant Democrats.
Militant centrists?
Exactly. Militant centrists. Moderates gone wild.
Now, you say in the Anti-American Manifesto that the story of the USA, as we've known it, is drawing to a close, and as you've just referred to, that the collapse is happening now. Now, I don't want to spend a lot of time on the collapse, but I think you lay it out very cogently. Talk about some of the highlights of that collapse, and why do you think it's happening now?
I think that what we're witnessing is the hangover from a process that really began after World War II. You know, the last big wave of revolutions took place in the late 18th and the first half of the 19th centuries. And that was a response to the collapse of the primarily agricultural economy and the rise of industrial capitalism. And what happened was, during that time, big capital and the ruling classes seized the advantage of the chaos to try to drive a bargain with workers that was very unfavorable to the vast majority of people. So you had people working in factories 7 days a week, 16 hours a day, child labor, and so on. The story of the 19th and the first half of the 20th centuries was the story of the working class rebelling against that and trying to negotiate for a better bargain for them. And sort of a rough equilibrium was established, I think, by World War II and certainly by the 1950s, where labor and management had kind of learned to cooperate with one another. And there was enough wealth pouring in, certainly in the United States and in the Western industrialized nations, that there was enough profit for everybody. That bargain started to collapse, I think, in the 1970s and 1980s, when we started to see this transition from the late industrial capitalism into something new, which we now know as the knowledge economy, the information age, the dot-coms, the internet, etc. And so now you're seeing exactly the same process that happened 200 years ago, where in essence, the old conditions that Marx and Engels were responding to with the Communist Manifesto are more applicable than what we think of as, like, say, the New Deal. What we're looking at is neo-feudalism, where people are being asked to be represented not at all in their relations with management and with employers. And so now, again, there's a time of rebellion that's starting to foment. And I think that what we're seeing now is the collapse of the United States as the leading dominant capitalist nation and empire is, in a sense, the most overextended of the old order, because you have a country here that is overextended economically, certainly. You have a national debt that's 14% of gross domestic product that hasn't been that high since 1943, when we were revving up for World War II and the invasion of Europe. You have, obviously, an overextended empire, as Chalmers Johnson documented incredibly well in his last book, with over 650,000 men and women under arms around the world, not including the 2 to 3 million more mercenaries and private contractors who are also working directly for the U.S. taxpayer. Each one of those 3 million personnel cost $1 million a year to keep in the field. Each of them has 8 support personnel behind them. So we are literally spending 54% of the federal tax dollar on the military. Of that 54%, and this is the part I think is amazing, 19% of that 54% is literally debt service on old wars that we are no longer fighting. So it's obviously unsustainable. In a sense, the deficit hawks on the right and the Tea Party folks are right. This can't go on. It's not as simplistic as we all have to live, the government has to live within its budget the same way that families have to live within their budget. But still, we are wildly overextended. And then, of course, there's the blowback issues from, as you know, 9/11. Essentially, you can't oppress half the planet for decades at a time and expect not everybody to hate you. That has consequences. There's also the environmental collapse that we're seeing. I mean, you don't have to be an outdoorsman to talk to fishermen, and they'll tell you that their catches have been dropping precipitously. At one point, a couple of years ago, Britain literally ruled officially that they no longer have a fishing industry as a substantial part of their economy. Now, as an island nation, if you know anything about history, that's a shocking fact. There is no river in Great Britain that is considered to have any fish. So the environmental collapse is wholesale. It is vast. Climate change is accelerating at a rapid pace. So, you know, what will ultimately cause the United States to collapse and the Western capitalist system? Nobody really knows what will come first. All you know is that it's kind of like when you have a friend who drinks and gets into fights and drives drunk and picks fights in bars and doesn't show up to work. You're not really sure exactly how they're going to crash, but you know it's coming somehow. And that's what we've got. The U.S. has been engaged in some seriously destructive behavior for a long time. arguably since its conception. And now the bill is coming due, and it feels like it, because it's hard to imagine, unlike, for instance, in the 1990s when we saw the beginning of the internet economy, it's hard to imagine what new economic activity is on the horizon that's going to somehow replace the millions and millions of jobs that have been lost since 2008 alone. We currently have a country where 90 million out of 300 million people are structurally unemployed, and that is crazy.
Are you including underemployment in that?
I am including underemployment. Yeah, I mean, I'm not talking about a little bit of underemployment, but significant underemployment. You know, if people are earning, a small fraction of what they should be earning for their education level, then essentially they're underemployed. They're unemployed because they're still going to lose their house. They're still going to have to sell their car. They're still going to end up living under a bridge. It's just going to take longer.
So, Ted Rall, you say in the Anti-American Manifesto, not only the personal is political, but also that the political is personal. We've just been talking about unemployment, underemployment, people's lack of rights, of a contract at work, whatsoever. You have your own story to tell about that. I wonder if you could tell that and also include what I found unbelievably shocking provision that you were asked to sign, to agree to, in order to get severance pay.
In 2006, I was hired as a editor of acquisitions at United Feature Syndicate, which is part of the E.W. Scripps newspaper chain. And my job was to find new comic strips and puzzles and columns, that sort of thing, for newspapers. And they liked me pretty well. But as sometimes happens, the person that I used to work most closely with left the company and was replaced by someone who didn't like me as much. And she and my Uber boss kind of conspired to get rid of me. So there was a round of layoffs, and I was called into the office and let go. Now, the thing is, that's obviously that story has happened to millions of people in the last couple of years, and certainly before that, too. And the reason I brought up the story was not to whine about it, but to sort of explain how it feels, the sense of helplessness. So one of the first things I did was to contact an attorney to see if I had any way of trying to, get a settlement out of them, because I had brought in a lot of money to the company. I was entitled, in my opinion, to I had been under my contract. I was supposed to get a certain percentage of revenues that I had never received, and I felt cheated, and I wanted to see if I could get it. And all the attorneys that I talked to told me the same thing, that it would be very, very, very difficult to get anywhere in the courts because the system is so rigged against workers. And so, ultimately what I tried to do is to just take my severance pay and go away and go find something new. The severance package was unbelievably cheap. Although I'm sure to some people listening to this, they'll be jealous, but they offered me $5,700. Now, that might sound like, I'm sure there are people who've been let go without receiving a penny, but of course, after taxes, it would have been like $3,500 in New York. So they sent me this very long severance agreement, which I had to read through, and several provisions stood out, and one of them was that I would never in perpetuity ever be allowed to work for another media company. So, I'm a syndicated cartoonist, I'm an author, I have books published by major media companies, I have a contract right now with Farrar, Straus & Giroux.
This is, in fact, your career. This is your life.
Exactly. This has been my career for most of my life. And I mean, I started drawing cartoons for newspapers when I was 15 years old. So, and I'm 47. So I was, obviously I couldn't sign that. So I called them up and I talked to the HR lady, and she said, well, we can't change that. And I said, well, I can't sign it. And she said, well, you should just sign it. I said, I'm not going to sign that. I need to work. And she said, well, you don't have to worry about it. We won't enforce that. And I said, well, if you're not going to enforce it, why don't you change it? Well, we can't change it because this is a, this is a reduction in force. And I said, so? She said, well, a reduction in force means that you can't change the agreement. I'm like, reduction in force isn't even a legal term. It's just corporate jargon that HR people use. It doesn't have any basis whatsoever in law. And anyway, we went back and forth like that. In the end, though, they refused to change a word. They just wouldn't negotiate. So I had to walk away, and I didn't get any severance. And I guess the good news was it wasn't so much money that it was going to really make a big difference. But I was kind of amazed at their attitude, because it was so unreasonable.
So you've kind of summed it up for us where we are now. Much of your book, Ted Rall, The Anti-American Manifesto, is talking about what can we do about this. And I found it very interesting because I think you pretty convincingly lay out the case for revolution in this country in a way that I think very few people, much less folks who've been in the media and who've been in the mainstream media, because your cartoons, although they have been biting, wonderful satire ever since the beginning, and I have enjoyed them, you know, have been in the New York Times, have been syndicated all over the place. You go places where very few people do go. First, lay out briefly why you think a revolution is necessary in this country.
I'm glad that you asked, you used the word necessary, because I think that there's some people who think that it would be fun, or that it would be, I suppose there's elements of it that would be fun. Probably the cool graphics would be fun. Revolution is, I think, something that history proves is only undertaken out of despair, and when there is no other way. When you know, if the current system were reformable in the least, or it were tolerable in the least, then I would argue, I would be up there arguing against revolution. But I find that it is neither. I think it's intolerable to live in the world's richest nation, which uses most of its wealth, all of its wealth, to kill and murder and oppress people around the world and here in the United States, and has absolutely, is shamelessly violating the principles it claims to adhere to. And it's also, while that wealth is squandered on murder and genocide, most people here are suffering, and there's absolutely no help available to them whatsoever. If you lost your job, or you're facing foreclosure, you know, you're literally being treated like crap. And it's also, I think the system is also plainly unreformable. And I think that's something that I laid out in the book pretty clearly. I think that, you know, the election of Barack Obama, at least to Democrats, is kind of proof of what I'm talking about. I mean, I think Barack Obama is about as progressive and well-intentioned and as far left as this system is capable of allowing to become president of the United States.
Oh, really? I mean, I think people like, to become president as opposed to a politician.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, we're not going to ever have a President Kucinich. We're not going to have a President Nader or a President Dean. So, I mean, Obama is probably the best we can do, the best we can see. And, you know, it was interesting because when he came in 2009, he really had the opportunity, an unprecedented opportunity, not just for a Democratic president, but really for any president, to push through anything he wanted. I mean, he had 59 seats in the Senate, overwhelming control of the House of Representatives, veto-proof majority. He could have just gone on television and said, "We're going to do this. We're going to nationalize some banks. We're going to do. We're going to pull out of Iraq right away, et cetera, et cetera." But he continued or accelerated most heinous policies of the Bush administration. He kept Guantanamo open. He actually is unknown to most Americans, moving many of the Guantanamo victims and detainees to Afghanistan, to a new detention facility at Bagram Air Base, which is going to be bigger and more secretive and less accessible to counsel than Guantanamo. The torture provisions continue on the books. America still tortures. Nothing has changed. There's a lot of pretty words. Oh, you know, we don't torture. Now the military doesn't torture, but the CIA does it. So what's the difference? And so on. I mean, the bailouts that began with TARP under Bush, accelerated under Obama, the lack of assistance to distressed homeowners and renters has continued without change under Obama. I mean, it's almost like Obama just wishes the economy would get better, but isn't willing to actually do anything to make it happen. Obviously, the war in Iraq continues. He's expanding the war in Afghanistan. Now, in fairness, he promised that. But when he became president in 2009, he should have realized that the economy had changed so dramatically that the country could no longer afford it. But again, he continues. So if you're on the left, or if you're a progressive, or if you're a traditional liberal, you have to ask yourself, what has the Democratic Party done for me lately? And I would say, well, since 1964, not a hell of a lot. And, you know, this should not really just be a discussion on the left, because the same principles occur on the right. I mean, let's say you adhere to traditional conservative values, like limited government, capping deficit spending, fiscal conservatism, libertarian attitudes towards allowing people to live their own lives. Again, neither party stands for those policies. Both parties are running up spectacular deficits. Both of them think it's perfectly okay to read your mail and listen to your phone calls. So it's what's funny is that the two major political parties don't really represent very many Americans at all. And when you have a situation like that, you have a dual party monopoly on the system, and that exists really primarily for just ensuring the continuation of short-term corporate profits, then it's obvious that we have two choices as Americans. We can either decide we are going to tolerate this, we are going to allow the country to go down the toilet, and us along with it. We accept that our living standards will constantly decline. We will watch the planet die and rot around us. And we will not lift a finger to stop it. And we will just go on the ride into oblivion. But I don't think that's the American way. I don't think that's the human way. You know, we're here as the result of 2 million years of evolution of people who clawed and scraped and struggled to get to survive. And I don't think we're just going to lay down and die.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Ted Rall about his latest book, The Anti-American Manifesto. Yet there are those then who would say, well, now is the time to really build a mass movement, and, you know, for Americans to move to parties like the Green Party on the left, the Tea Party on the right. I mean, you could look at the Tea Party and say, well, there's a mass movement that has been able in one or two short years to capture the House of Representatives, for example. So why do you feel that structurally electoral politics is not the way to go?
The system is rigged, whether it's the 2000 election with Bush v. Gore or the shenanigans in Ohio in 2004. Or, for that matter, you mentioned the Green Party. You know, the reason that the Green Party isn't more prominent isn't because they don't have good politics or good people. It's because the system is rigged against third parties. The reason that the Tea Party has worked is because it's not a real party. It's a subsidiary of the Republican Party. Now, the Green Party as a real third party, like the Libertarians, are obscure and will always remain obscure because of obscure provisions that the two major parties have conspired to put on the ballots in every state. You have to typically get at least 5 or 10 or 15% of the vote, depending on the state, in two consecutive elections in order to be listed on the ballot in the next election. Well, that's probably not going to happen, which is why it's really hard to get listed on the ballot. You're not going to be able to break through that dual party hegemony. So the system itself really doesn't have any space for anything that does not promote its own agenda. The Tea Party has been allowed to thrive because, A, it's a part of, it's the right wing of the GOP, but also because it's an example of the authoritarian wing of our sort of pseudo-democratic system. allowing itself to be prompted by the right-wing factions of the people into doing what it really wants to do anyway and move forward with a more radical right agenda. The Tea Party people are being used. Now, that said, I find the Tea Party movement interesting and laudable insofar as it is people who are angry at the system. They know that they're being screwed by banks, and they know that their living standards are dropping, and it doesn't feel right. Where they're wrong is in where they're placing the blame. They think it's the poor and illegal immigrants. The real danger is the rich and, you know, and corporations. But in terms of the anger, I have more in common with the Tea Party people than I do with liberal Democrats who think everything's fine because an African American is president, and it really isn't.
Ted Rall, you say in the book, in the Anti-American Manifesto, that you can't use electoral politics, but you also say that a vision of what's could be different. I mean, there are others, for example, in the progressives who say that we have to create the new world within the old. There are the building of resilient communities, people who are preparing for a different way. There's Yes Magazine, for example, which talks about how people can do things differently. In other words, the focus is on the vision of what can be different. But you say, we don't need to work that out. We just need to do the revolution. Walk us through your reasoning on that.
Well, first and foremost, I think we don't have time to build a mass movement. You know, we currently have, you know, a planet that is just shut. If you pay attention, it's got to scare you. I recently took a flight from Europe to the United States where the pilot was explaining that we would be arriving 2.5 hours early because the jet stream has started to shut down. So it's much easier to fly from east to west across the Atlantic Ocean. And he was urging the passengers to write to their elected representatives, although he said it's probably too late. And he said all the pilots are well aware of this on international halls, that the upper atmosphere has already changed. And it's probably not coming back. And we're seeing the early results this year with excessively cold weather, ironically, in the United States, and excessively warm in northern Canada because of this change in the jet stream. So, I mean, you know, if it would take another 40 or 50 years to work within the system, build a popular movement, and change things from within, well, there's not going to be much left in 50 years. You know, we may be suffering mass famine by then. So we don't have that time. We really, and I also think it's unfair to all the people who are today 10 years old to tell them, you know what, your life is going to suck because you have to wait for us to build a popular movement for the next 50 years. It's just, it doesn't seem like because we laid down on the job for the last 40 years, that's acceptable. Also, I think that we are looking at a situation where it's probably not likely that we will be able to form a mass movement anyway. You know, as a society, we are so atomized now by technology that we're all individuals. You know, back in the 1950s, home builders stopped building porches. And the reason that they stopped building porches was because of television. Everybody was inside. Now, before, in houses that are from the 1940s and earlier, people had porches. And they hung out, and they didn't have air conditioning. That's also part of it. But they hung out on their porch, and they waited for their neighbors to pass by. And they'd say, hey, you want to come over and have a pop? And you'd hang out on the swing, on the porch swing. And, you know, those same people during the day might work at a factory where they belonged to a union that was tied into a national organization that was affiliated with a political party. Now we're all individuals. We're all, even when we are in the public space, our eyes are down looking at our mobile device. So, you know, we're not going to be able in this environment to try to get people out into the streets. People point to the positive effects of technology with the Al-Quds Day protests in Iran in 2009 and, you know, the Green Revolution that sort of was aborted and didn't really work. But only like 1% of 1% of 1% of Iranians had internet access. It just wasn't really true that they were all tweeting and Facebooking their way to revolution. The truth was that they were outside in the streets because that's where revolution happens. And I think that what we're going to have here as we've seen in Tunisia and Egypt, is a spontaneous explosion of long pent-up societal and political forces and economic forces, not least, that are just going to explode in some unpredictable way that's going to bring people out. And the collectivity is going to occur as the result of the revolution.
Political cartoonist, author, and revolutionary, Ted Raw. We'll talk more after a break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Just before the break, our guest, cartoonist and author Ted Rall, was talking about just how a revolution in the U.S. could happen. He says, much like Egypt, he thinks it will be a spontaneous uprising, but one the left has to be ready to join after it started.
200 years ago, and I would say through the 1960s, everyone thought that what you had to do was use the movement to educate people about the revolution, and then that's momentum would carry through and create the revolution. But now you can't do that, and I don't think it's even necessarily a good idea, because when you have the surveillance state that is probably the biggest impediment to revolution, they're reading your email, they're listening to your phone calls, they know everything that you're thinking before you've thought it. Well, in a way, it's better for you not to be doing anything. I mean, if you join a group that is, militant, but say totally operating within legal strictures, what you're doing is holding up your hand in the air and saying, hi, later on when the clampdown comes, please come round me up, arrest me, and disappear me. But by not having those kinds of organizations, we have a real strength. Because the system has become so completely impervious to any kind of resistance, we're setting up the strongest weapon we have in the future, which is that the system will not know who its enemies really are. And I love that.
And yet, you have written a book. Many analysts or people who have thought about this have talked about how a government, a system like this, can only operate with the consent of the governed. So, you know, manufacturing consent. So certainly there is a place for people like yourself, people like Noam Chomsky, who you criticize in the book.
But from a position of love.
Absolutely. But you do say that those folks are not where it's at. Doing that is not where it's at. So where is, I mean, my sense is that you're going a little bit over to an extreme to make it a point, because clearly there has to be some connection between the educative function, which is something that you're engaged in, and the revolutionary function.
That's right. Well, I mean, the difference between me and Noam Chomsky and Katrina Vandenhoevel and Arianna Huffington and Michael Moore is that I favor the overthrow of the United States government and the complete change of the current economic structure to something that is radically different. Those people do not. Those people do not want to see the White House stormed. They do not want to see President Obama arrested and put on trial. I do. I am advocating for revolution. These are the other individuals that I mentioned. They know that revolution is necessary, and they know that real change is impossible without it. I mean, these are people who are at least as smart as I am. But whether they're afraid to say so because they're afraid of being marginalized professionally, or they're afraid to say so because they feel like people won't listen to them if they're quote-unquote extreme, they are holding back and they're refusing to step over the line. But they're going to be left behind. They're going to be discredited when the revolution comes. And I think they're already discredited in the eyes of the people who are suffering the most. I mean, if you're you know, an African American who's currently facing a death penalty charge and it doesn't have adequate legal representation because you can't afford it, or if you're hanging upside down in some secret CIA prison, or if you've just gotten evicted from your home because you lost your job and the government hasn't helped you out, or your child has died because you couldn't afford adequate medical care, and so on. You look at these people and you say, you are choosing to let this system, this evil system, stay in place. And instead, you can decide to act and do something about it. Now, even in my case, I don't consider myself radical at all. I think I'm a moderate. I think I'm a centrist. I think I'm just talking common sense. To me, it's the most obvious thing in the world that when a system doesn't work, you get rid of it. If you had a car that was working like the United States political and economic system, you would get rid of it. You'd get a new one. So this isn't about, you know, the love of singing the Internationale in the streets and breaking things. This is about getting rid of something that doesn't work. And if you could replace it with something that worked better without breaking anything, that would be great. I'm all for that.
I guess that's the real question, though, because I think a lot of people, I mean, I think you're talking about a spontaneous social uprising, and we've seen plenty of them over the last 20 years. I mean, there's Egypt, there's Tunisia just most recently, but there's also Germany in 1989, there was the Soviet Union. I mean, these things do happen. But a lot of people in the United States think that if that happens, it's going to be a right-wing, extreme right-wing fascist kind of movement. What is the counterbalance to that? How do we prevent that from happening?
Well, that's the origin of the anti-American manifesto. And I agree, most people are right. There is no left in the United States at all. And I'm not saying that to be glib. There is literally no left. I mean, a left is a political movement that seeks the complete replacement of the right-wing status quo with something new. We don't have anything like that. The Democratic Party isn't that. Liberals aren't that. People like Michael Moore are not that. Michael Moore is not that. And what there is a whole lot of right. I mean, the Republican Party as a quote-unquote mainstream party is actually very far to the right. I mean, in France, it would be probably about along the lines from a policy standpoint as the National Front under Jean-Marie Le Pen. It's the GOP is a racist, xenophobic party. You know, and that's where the mainstream right begins, and it just goes crazy from there. When you go over to much of the Tea Party, not all, but the Sarah Palins, those people, there's almost no precedent for it in American politics. There's, you know, internationally, you'd have to look at movements like early Italian fascism to see, you know, the sort of militant corporatism.
You've got Father Coughlin and folks like that.
That's true. That's true. Father Coughlin. That's true. I forgot about him. But but it's just wacky. And then, you know, but it's true. There's people even to the far to the right of that, the Michigan militia, the Aryan Nation types in Idaho. And I really worry that like this lattice of far right, militant, highly energized politics, they're heavily armed, they're well organized, they're intelligent. They're ready to take over. And if when a vacuum is created within the federal or the state governments, those are the people who are going to step in. It's going to look like Margaret Atwood's story, the Handmaid's Tale, and you know, it's going to be like this weird blend of militarism and right-wing theocracy, Christian fundamentalism. It'll be like American Taliban, as people say. And what left is going to stop that? So the book is a cry in the wilderness. It is it's a hope that people will start to make space in their minds for thinking, you know, this type of politics, real politics, which is not what we see on C-SPAN, but real politics, the politics that happen in the streets, is something that should not be left to the right. The left should participate in it, and it should fight for control.
Now, you take that one step further, which is to talk about violent revolution. How does that work? I mean, you're saying we're not building a mass movement. We don't have these small cadres. You know, it's neither the Marxist-Leninist party of the vanguard, nor is it that community organizing model that those of us who remember did in the 60s. How does this work, and how do you keep it from not resulting in something worse than what it replaced?
Well, the rich and powerful don't give up money or power voluntarily. That's a fact. So there's never been, for that reason, any kind of radical, wholesale, political, or social change without the willingness to use violence. In other words, violence and or the credible threat of violence. Now, that said, even the most violent, blood-soaked revolutions have not mostly been about violence. I mean, most revolutionary activity is about organizing and strikes and agitation and demonstrations. That's most of what revolution is. But if there is not a credible threat of force, then there is no reason for the powers that be to respect you. Right now, we can see in Egypt kind of a crossroads where the revolutionary movement has to decide whether they're going to be content with sitting in Tahrir Square and conducting street battles with paid government protesters, or are they going to actually get busy and storm the presidential palace and throw out Mubarak, which is really the next logical step. It's what they need to do. They need to move the agenda forward. If they don't, they're going to lose. It's going to be co-opted. It'll end like Tiananmen Square. So there's it's a very difficult set of equations. I mean, in terms of avoiding something worse coming next, there is literally nothing you can do to avoid that. You know, what's going to happen is revolution is chaos. When the revolution occurs, even if you've planned it out well, ask the Mensheviks. What happens next? Who knows? New movements that were small suddenly become big. New movements emerge. Leaders emerge. If you're a good revolutionary, you're not going to try to plan the revolution in advance. What you're going to try to do is surf the revolution and guide it and recognize it when it happens and participate in it and hope that you can be part of it. But that's all you can do. Once you've unleashed this ferocious beast, it's on. Anything can happen. So I would say that, you can look at the histories of revolutions and just point to all the negative things that have followed them. I mean, the French Revolution led to, of course, the Terror and to Napoleon and arguably to 90 years of chaos. And it wasn't really, until 1871 that France emerged as a viable, republic that looked pretty much the way we would recognize it today, and that really enshrined the principles of the rights of man into the daily life of their people. And you could also say that, the Russian Revolution, they got Stalin and the purges and the gulags. And you could say that, the Chinese Revolution led to, the Great Leap Forward and the May 4th farms and the famines and all that and so on. So, but at the same time, I would look at the alternative. I mean, what if the Russians had not revolted? Would we be accepting a feudal state taking up the world's largest nation across the world's biggest landmass? Would it be okay to say that essentially people could just be owned for their labor and have no individual rights? I mean, if France had not revolted, I think slavery might still be legal today. The French enshrined in the West, the French enshrined the concept that all people have the same rights. And that idea has spread, and it's the most important idea in the world. I mean, I would say that if it took 100 million deaths to have that idea take root, it's worth it. Because that's the most important idea in Western civilization.
One thing that your book, Ted Rall, in the Anti-American Manifesto, one thing you don't really explore, you say that we can't kind of work out the whole new society. We can't know that, we don't have time. But there are a lot of people who do have an idea of how we can live sustainably within the earth. They are getting together to create what they call resilient communities that will be there no matter what happens. What do you think of those efforts? Do you feel that those are part of the revolutionary effort?
Well, my feelings are mixed about those people. I mean, on the one hand, I certainly think people have to do what they have to do to survive. And I also think that it's possible that the experiments that they're conducting will be able to be multiplied with the help of a more supportive central government, could be multiplied over a larger area, possibly. So that could, it could be great. But on the other hand, I also worry that they're engaged in a more extreme version of lifestyle activism. People who think that if they drive a Prius and separate their plastics from their glass, that they're good people and that they're doing good, when in reality all they're doing is acting selfishly to look out for their parochial interests, protecting themselves and their families, essentially just like the left wing version of survivalists who are stacking up on water and air biscuits and hanging out in the fallout shelter and not letting their neighbor in when the bomb goes off. I worry a lot about that because I feel like what we need is collective action. What we don't need is individual action. Individualism is what has gotten us into this mess in the first place.
Well, I think they would argue that they're doing collective action on the local community level.
Right. Well, like I said, I'm very mixed about that. I mean, I understand, you know, it's so hard to argue that, you know, against farmers markets. And it's, you know, I mean, it's hard to argue that, you know, buying locally is bad. I wouldn't argue that. I get worried when I see that a lot of energy directed into things that could be directed into something more meaningful. You know, if you're a 25-year-old computer coder and you spend all weekend volunteering at the farmers market, but you could, you know, write a worm that would hack Citicorp instead.
And that kind of brings us to phenomena like WikiLeaks. What do you think of that? Is that part of the revolution?
Information is power, always. And anything that exposes the inner workings of government is, I think, inherently good. In fact, you know, one of the books that I'm going to be working on as a sequel to the Anti-American Manifesto is going to be about answering the question, you know, what exactly will the new society look like and how it should be governed? And one of the things that I think is that government secrecy should be outlawed. Any government worthy of its people should conduct all of its business in the light of day. In other words, if there's a president, let's say we may not have a president, but if there's a president, he should not conduct any political business at any time when there isn't reporters and cameras present. And when he leaves, he goes home, he can just like watch television or whatever. So I think that WikiLeaks is performing a laudable service. And look, obviously, it helped inspire some of the outrage in Tunisia and Egypt. Here in the United States, however, I don't think it's possible to shock the American people. I mean, in the post-Watergate era, it seems that no scandal, Iran-Contra, Monica Lewinsky, anything has really been that Abu Ghraib has been capable of shaking the conscience of the American people. I mean, I receive emails from 9/11 truthers who think that 9/11 was an inside job or that it was faked or that missiles struck the World Trade Center and not, you know, but I don't believe any of those theories. But one of the things I always ask them is, why do you care so much? Because in my opinion, if it turned out that the U.S. government had brought down the World Trade Center intentionally and it could be proven, it wouldn't change anything. That's not going to cause a revolution here.
The last part of your book, in the last few pages, you say people need to work with anybody and everybody. And the question came to me, you mentioned the Tea Party before. Do you think that there is a way that there is in fact, an imperative for people to put aside some of their differences and to try to find some common ground between right and left?
Yes. Hell yes. There's no other choice. I mean, when you consider that we would be going up against the military and economic and governmental and organizational prowess of this insane monolith, you really think it's cool to say, well, I'm a socialist. I don't want to work with communists. Look, you have to take everybody who's willing to work with you. And I'm not an organizer, so I'm not a person who's in a position to know how to make the Tea Party work side by side with communists. But that said, there are people like that who can do that. And that's what we need. We need those alliances of convenience. In the book, I refer to Ahmed Shah Massoud, the organizer of the anti-Soviet resistance in Afghanistan during the 1980s. And he famously toasted a meeting of rival political and tribal factions by holding up a cup of tea and saying, "First, we kill the Russians. Next, we kill each other." And that is what we need to do here. We need for all the lefties and all the righties who understand the problem and understand that the system needs to be changed to first get rid of the system. And after that, we will all go kill each other.
And finally, I want to ask you about being a cartoonist. You mentioned before that you have been able to say what folks like Michael Moore and Katrina Vandenhoevel do not, and that is that we need a revolution. Do you think that the fact that you are a cartoonist, is there something about that that has enabled you to leapfrog the so-called credibility concerns that they may have? You know, they write serious, so-called serious articles, whereas you draw cartoons. Do you think that's given you a freedom that they don't have?
You know, maybe in the case of journalists like Katrina, certainly, I think that's right. But in terms of Michael Moore, I mean, I think he's kind of just a stand-up comic, and he's kind of a comedian. There's nothing stopping him. Michael, come over to the light, to the white light side of the force. We need you. But I don't think it's the cartoonist thing completely, because look, I mean, how many other cartoonists are calling for revolution? And I know quite a few of them who all agree that it's necessary. What's really shocked me about this book has been the utter lack of rage. I mean, people are completely left, right, even middle, are mostly in agreement that the system is moribund and in need of change, and that probably nothing short of violent revolution will affect that. I am stunned by that. I expected all sorts of crazed howling. But yeah, there's been some complaints, and you could Google them and find them, but nothing much. I mean, I got much more rage when I do controversial cartoons about like 9/11 widows or Pat Tillman. This is like nothing. Here it is. You write a book that calls for the overthrow of the government and no one cares. And it sells decently and it's fine. And you get interviewed on TV and on cool radio shows. So it's like, it's bizarre. But I think that people are, they're afraid to go there. And I think it's mostly professional. It's for professional reasons. They think that that's too far out there. I agree with you, but that's too far out there. But this is how it always is. I mean, you know, when the revolution comes, I will no doubt be criticized for having been too timid and not having taken up arms and I was a wimp early on. And because these people don't recognize is they've spent their entire lives living in the old order. The old order is dying. It's going to be gone. The situation, the political situation today, the entire situation, both within the normal D versus R paradigm and more generally, more broadly, is radicalizing rapidly. People are going to be on the far left and on the far right, and there's really not any there's no room for the center in a crisis, because the center doesn't offer any solutions. The center offers a let's muddle through and let's hope everything's fine. Well, that's fine when a society faces no major or serious problems, then really that's okay. When you're talking about where to put the new stop sign or what the speed limit should be, you don't need radical politics. In fact, radical politics are stupid. Mm-hmm. But when you have really radical problems, where you have a disparity of income, for instance, that is one of the highest in the world, in fact, higher than in Tunisia and in Egypt, when you have an unemployment rate that in real terms is actually higher than in Tunisia and Egypt, then you know that you're going to have to do a lot to fix that. And from a right-wing perspective, it's going to take some major changes. From a left-wing perspective, it's going to take some major changes. But sort of just hoping for the best isn't going to cut it. You know, right now we have very dry tinder, a lot of sparks flying around, and one of them's going to catch. It's only a matter of time, and I don't think it's a matter of much time.
Well, Ted Rall, your book is The Anti-American Manifesto. It's a breath of fresh air. It's fascinating. It's a terrific read. And thanks so much for joining us here on Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me. It was great.
Ted Rall blogs at Ted Rall's Rawl Blog. You can find a link to it and a link to an excerpt from the Anti-American Manifesto at writersvoice.net. Next, we call up poet Martina Spada for a poem about another pro-democracy movement, this one in Mexico. Welcome, Martine, to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. The poem I'm going to read today relates to the Egyptian uprising in a very particular way. It has to do with Mexico and the Zapatistas. Back in February of 2001, in fact, 10 years ago this month, the Zapatistas marched from one end of Mexico to the other to demand the passage of an indigenous civil rights bill, right, what they called an Indian Bill of Rights. And I caught up to this march and this movement in a place called Tepoztlán in the state of Morelos, which is where the original revolutionary Emiliano Zapata came from. And so the poem itself is based on the experience of witnessing the marchers coming into Tepoztlán and holding a rally there. The poem itself is called Sing Zapatista, March 6, 2001, Tepoztlán, State of Morelos, Mexico. Sing the word Tepoztlán, place of copper, pueblo of cobblestones and purple blossoms amid the cliffs, serpent god ablaze with plumage peering from the shaven rock. Sing the word Zapata, bandoliers crossing his chest like railroad tracks about to explode, rebellion's black iris in 1910, in his eye the peasants of Morelos husking rifles stalk by stalk from the cornfields. Sing the word Zapatista, masked rebels riding now in a caravan without rifles, tracking the long rosary of blood beaded and stippled across the earth by other rebels the color of earth, bus panting uphill, saddled with ghosts dangling legs from the roof. Sing the words Felix Cerdan, age 11 when he straddled the horse to ride with Zapata, witness to a century's harvest of campesino skulls, abundant as melons, twined in white mustache and blanket beside the comandantes on the platform. Sing the word comandante, 23 of the faceless, masked in black so their brown skin could grow eyes and mouths, smuggling Mayan tongues to the microphone on the plaza where the church drowses in dreams of Latin by rote. Sing the word durito, hard little one, scarab on a banner draped across the face of the church where bells bang to welcome the rebels as the scarab people cluster below, shouting their vow never to be crushed by the shoe. Sing the word zapatealo, tap and stamp of women dancing in the plaza to the hummingbird rhythms of Veracruz, guitarist in fedora watching his fingers skitter like scarabs across the wood, shawled dancer lost in the percussion of her feet. Sing the word Marcos, el subcomandante, and listen when he says above the crowd chanting his name, Marcos does not exist. I am a window. I am a mirror. I am you. You are me.
You know, what strikes me about this is the thought that I had watching the Egyptian uprising. It came to me, you know, we are all Egyptians. I kept on thinking of so much how these revolutions really embody all of our hopes and expectations.
Absolutely. It's universal. And in fact, what Marcos says at the end of the poem is not only a political statement, it's based on Mayan philosophy, which now resonates when we see the events happening halfway across the world in Egypt.
Well, Martine Espada, thanks so much for reading this beautiful poem. Give us the title again and tell us where it's published.
Yes, the poem is called Sing Zapatista. It comes from a collection called Alabanza, A-L-A-B-A-N-Z-A, New and Selected Poems, and widely available in paperback.
Martine Espada writes and teaches poetry at the University of Massachusetts, Amherst. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Be sure to visit us at writersvoice.net to find out who's coming on next week, listen to archive shows, and leave your comments and suggestions. That's www.writersvoice.net. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM Portland, 91.9 FM Hood River and Nagorge, 104.3 FM Philomath and Corvallis.
Tune into Between the Covers every Thursday at 11 a.m. to hear interviews with locally and nationally known authors from both fiction and nonfiction. Between the Covers, only on KBOO Portland.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946. With service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212. In Vancouver, it's 360-694-1234 or radiocab.net. Next up, we've got two interviews by KBOO contributor Don Mill, who has invited all Oregon candidates for the 2014 election to share their jobs on his podcast, Between Us. The first is Republican John Huffman, who's running for re-election in Oregon's 59th district. He talked with Don about his constituent, his constituents, his family, and his level of frustration over how he feels the legislature is sometimes sidelined. Stay tuned at 6:30 for Don Gavitt, a Democrat and Portland public school teacher running for the Oregon House, in the 42nd district. He talked with Don Merrill about what he plans to bring to the legislature as a teacher and what he wants to bring his students at their parents as a legislator.
I'm Don Merrill, and I'm talking with Republican John Huffman. Mr. Huffman is running for re-election in Oregon's 59th district. Mr. Huffman, thanks for talking with me.
You bet. Thanks, Don.
The first question I wanted to ask you is, I see that you have a lot of very varied experience. You had an orchard, you've worked on cars, but the experience I'm most interested in is your broadcasting experience. Tell me a little bit about that. How did you get into radio?
I had been managing a Ford Mercury dealership in Missouri and ended up in Oregon and had an opportunity to step into Q104 Radio in the Dalles, Oregon, 100,000 watt FM, and step in as the sales manager. And a few months later, the absentee owner from Southern California called me up and said that he wanted me to become the GM, and so that started a long relationship. He also happened to have a pear orchard in the Parkdale, Oregon area.